You're listening to KX93.5 FM.
FM. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's time for the Friendship Show.
Friendship Show.
With your hosts, Dawn Price, Mark Miller, and Scott Hayes. The Friendship Show.
Friendship Show.
Friendship Show.
Good morning. It's 9 a.m. You're listening to KX93.5 FM. This is the Friendship Show. My name is Mark Miller. I'm here with my co-host, Scott Hayes. Good morning, Mr. Hayes.
Well, hello, Mark. Am I on? I just want to make sure I can't hear myself. Okay, April says I am. How are we doing this morning, Mark?
Great.
Yep.
I think we're doing great.
Yeah. Well, were we talking about anything coming into the show about your likes and dislikes? I forget. There seems like something popped into my head. You're a big fan of somebody.
My likes and dislikes?
Yeah. Wasn't that you? I was chatting with you.
No? I don't know. I don't know what my likes or dislikes would have to do with anything.
Okay. Yeah. I got some ideas.
Dawn Price is not here this morning.
Yeah, where is she, by the
way? She's in Arizona.
How fun. Is it fun?
It is fun. I think she's on some sort of family sibling sort of vacation.
That sounds good.
But she is going to, I think, call in later because she wanted to be a part of this morning's show.
I'm looking forward to the show, too, by the way.
In case people don't know, we can spill the beans. Randy Kraft, the author of a newly published novel, Colors of the Wheel,
right, is
here this morning.
Yeah.
I would just say we have been trying to get Randy Kraft as a guest on this show for probably a year or more.
It's a coup.
And she has managed to get out of it up until now.
And I got to believe most listeners know who Randy Kraft is, right? I mean, she's a local iconic person. She does a lot of writing for the community.
She does lots of writing. She has a regular column in one of the local newspapers.
Right, yeah.
The Indy.
Oh, Randy Kraft is here.
Yeah.
Get on the mic.
I'm on.
Saddle up close. Get up close to that thing.
Mm-hmm. Didn't we have a relative of Randy's on not too long ago?
This is sort of a family thing. Apparently, it's some sort of rite of passage in your family that all of the women have to write a book.
I'm waiting for my other daughter to get on board.
To write a book?
Yeah.
Maybe, we're going to, of course, talk about the book, this one, in your career, but we'd love to chat about your family. You have an incredibly interesting family who are doing all sorts of interesting things.
I have two fabulous daughters.
And what do they do?
As long as we're into it. My daughter is, while we're into this, she's a naturopath, a practitioner of natural medicine.
She's a tinkerist.
Yes, she's an herbalist.
Right.
An herbalist, and some might say a witch.
Oh, my gosh.
Would you say that?
No.
Oh.
And she lives in Mexico, where she also practices Dana Medicina Natural. That's her handle.
Oh, really?
Her website, if anyone's interested. She's very good. And she studied at the London College of Natural Medicine for 6 years. That's where she did her graduate work. And my younger daughter, Julie Kraft, lives in San Diego. Julie Kraft Markley. I have to keep remembering that she was married last year.
She was.
Yes. And she is a marriage and family therapist, as you know, and the author of The Mindfulness Workbook for Addiction.
An incredibly
successful book.
It just won another award, didn't it? It won some award down in San Diego.
I think four altogether. Last year it won the San Diego Book Award for its category. Yeah, it's won a few.
It really is a very insightful sort of book with a very refreshing and, I would say, sensitive approach to dealing with addiction.
Thank you, yes.
And in a very clear way, where you can read the book and then you can do something. I was very impressed by
addiction
it.
Addiction of all types.
Yeah. I was very impressed by it.
Thank you.
All right. Just so we don't gloss over this, you have your own show now.
No, I have my own show with Robert Palmer. And, there was that opening between 8 and 9 before the Friendship Show.
Right.
And today was our first show between 8 and 9. And it's sort of an eclectic, what's happening, skits and politics and
news. You do skits?
Well, whatever. We're still kind of massaging the process. But our first morning was an hour ago. And I thought, Megan, you think it went pretty well, no?
I think so. Yeah. It wasn't a total train wreck.
Yeah, no. Megan's going to be on the show.
A compliment of a sort.
This is the standard?
No. I'm just playing. It was fun. I hope people were having fun with us.
I was listening to it on the way in. I thought it sounded very good. I thought you guys sounded great.
Megan's going to be an actual reporter, too, for the show. So she's going to occasionally go out and interview people and bring in reports and have those.
Get my hands dirty and talk to the people.
So it'll be fun. Okay. I think it's a good segue into this show, too.
Do you have a name for the show? What do you guys
call
it?
Radio Caravan.
Radio Caravan?
Yeah, I don't know. We were just playing around with some words and somebody popped up with Caravan and I sort of liked it and I think we all liked it. So
it's
we just added radio to the beginning and it worked.
Caravan. Yeah. So what? Explain that. What does that
I
mean?
I don't know.
Buy a caravan.
Like a journey, a group of people going along on a.
Because
we're not stuck to any one topic.
Oh, wow.
A caravan implies a long journey, too.
Yeah.
I think.
Does it?
I think.
And you meet some interesting people along the way.
Oh, I get it. A caravan as like a verb, not as like a noun.
No, we're not sitting here in a wagon.
Oh, well, now
ready
I get
to
it,
hit
though.
The Oregon Trail.
And by the way, I will say that I thought Robert Palmer was exceptional. I mean, first time in the studio, on the microphone, he's just a very giving, creative guy, and it just worked out beautifully. So I'm happy to be partnering up with him.
Yeah, and he does his research. I mean, he kind of really knows what he's talking about.
Oh. Which,
something that no one could ever accuse this show of doing too much research.
He's a very bright guy, and that's going to be very valuable for the show.
So. Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you guys are on.
Thanks
ahead
for mentioning
of us.
It, by the way.
Yeah, I'm glad you guys are on ahead of us.
No, thank you.
Okay, we should take a music break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to get into Colors of the Wheel with author Randy Kraft. Right now, let's see. What should we listen to? How about Michael Fronte?
Oh, yes.
Should we listen to some Michael Fronte?
I adore him.
I believe this is off Rebel Rockers, Michael Fronte, Hey, Hey, I Love You.
Come down, selector.
Luck I had was you, and I know one thing that I love you. I say, hey, I'll be gone today, but I'll be back. Come around the way, it seems like everywhere I go, the more I see, the less I know. I say, hey.
I love you, baby.
We're back here at the Friendship Show. You're listening to KX 93.5, Laguna's only FM. My name is Mark Miller. I'm here with co-host Scott Hayes. Dawn Price is going to be calling in from Arizona.
Yeah, that sounds good.
That's where she is this morning. And we're here with author Randy Kraft.
Author. Wow.
Author Randy Kraft.
That's nice.
Here's what I want you to know, okay? I'm going to read something to you. On the night of the 2012 presidential election, a black girl stands her ground against an assault by a white boy. A judge will decide if she goes to trial. Waiting in the courtroom with her are her white parents and her blended family, many shades of brown. So is the setting of Colors of the Wheel. Randy.
Yes.
I have to tell you that, you know, I sort of know you a little bit. And when I think about what kind of novel you would write, this sort of absolutely catches me by surprise that this is the novel that you would choose to write.
Good.
How did you decide on this?
Oh, my. You know, I didn't really make an active decision to write about race. It kind of decided for me. It started in 1999 with a short story I wrote in graduate school. And I don't remember what the assignment was. But I had just been reading Tilly Olson, a wonderful black writer from the 50s. And she was in my head. And one of her more iconic stories is a story called I Stand Here Ironing. It's a black mother contemplating her daughter's future, basically. And so I started writing this story about a woman, single mom with three kids. And I just saw her as a black woman. And I saw her children as lighter and imagined she had had a white husband. And wrote a story about a struggle she was in at that time. And then put the story away, because all those stories go in a drawer somewhere. Fast forward 2005 or 6, my daughter, Julie, who is a bit of a couch potato, a very cerebral person, suddenly, unexpectedly, starts running. And she takes up, you know, marathon running. And I don't know why I decided to write a story about her. And when I sat down to write the story, I suddenly had this thought that maybe she's the daughter of that woman. So now we have another generation of a daughter. And what happened to her, that daughter? Maybe she lived a difficult life and suddenly took up running. And next thing I know, I had a set of characters, and I started writing about them, and then they had white friends, and some of those white friends couldn't have children, so one of them adopted a black child, and suddenly I had this collection of families that were black, white, and brown, and I decided to go with it.
So one thing just sort of leads to another.
Absolutely.
You have, like, this matriarchal figure, and then all of a sudden your daughter appears as a character in the show.
Well, she's not
a character in the novel.
She's not really, but
right.
You know, she just inspired me to write something about that, yeah.
Very interesting.
They all connect in some ways, but they ultimately connect through this one girl who's the darkest in color, who's the youngest among them, and she's the one that in some way has to stand up for all of them.
I find that fascinating. So it wasn't a conscious decision to say, I'm going to write a book and this is what it's going to be.
No.
It's a sort of a compilation or a...
Well, it became a series of connected stories. And then, and I rewrote it many times, and it had a number of different themes, actually. And then I began to weave all the stories together so that it was more cohesive, and then use this character as the thread. And then it began to all make sense. I think when you write, this is not the first novel I've written, it's just the first I've published. And when you write, if you get into your characters and you go with them, then the story evolves. You know, they lead the way. I know there are writers who have outlines and they have agendas and they have stories to write, but I don't work that way.
Let me back up just a little bit. You know, I'm always curious. You know, I write myself.
I
do some stuff on the side. And I always want to know what initially inspired a writer to write. Anything in particular for you that just made you gravitate toward the process of writing?
I'm the first child in my family to go to college. My father was a high school dropout. My mother was a high school graduate. Yeah. Immigrant kids, they were. And I grew up in New York, and my mother was a just passionate believer in education and in reading. And so we we went to the library every week, and reading became huge for me. And somewhere along the line, I began to write, to have a passion for words. But I think one of the other things, it's funny, no one's ever asked me this question, but my father worked nights. Actually, he worked days and nights, but he was gone a lot at night. So I used to leave little notes for him about my day or something. And then he'd leave me a little note back.
Right.
And so we did communicate. I started communicating in the written word at a fairly young age. So maybe that was part of it.
I think that was a big part of it, probably.
It might have been.
Yeah. And on this novel, then, how long did it take you to write?
Consciously, I'd say I've been working on it consciously about 5 years.
About 5 years.
But I've been working on it intensively for the last three.
And I feel like, as a writer myself, I'm my own worst critic. I hate the process of writing. I just despise it. I don't do it unless I absolutely have to do it. Is that the same for you, or do you have you work from a different process?
I'm not happy if I'm not writing every day.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I do a lot of different kinds of writing.
Right.
So I have to compartmentalize. That's that's the hardest part for me.
Yeah.
If I could have devoted my life to fiction, I would have, but I like to eat.
Yeah.
So, you know, got to make a living.
Yeah.
So I have to change voices. There's the journalism. Then I write for nonprofits. I write newsletters and annual reports and grants, and that's a whole other voice.
Right.
And then I have to switch over to fiction.
Yeah.
But I'm always writing something, and I blog, and and I tweet. And I'm, you know, so I'm always writing something, and I'm not happy if I'm not.
And then this book, I just want to catch up then. The genre of the book, if you had to describe the genre, and if you had to sort of give us a, you know, that sort of movie pitch idea.
This could never be a movie.
No, I know. But, I mean, how would you kind of let readers know or listeners know really the genre of the book and this basic premise of the story?
It's not genre fiction in that it's not mystery, it's not history, it's not romance.
Okay.
It's sort of literary fiction, but it's not high literary.
Okay.
I think it's mainstream fiction. Most of the characters are, well, all of the key characters are women, although they are surrounded, obviously, by lovers and partners and friends, and who are mostly men. But it might be more appealing to women.
Okay.
And it is the story of people who are dealing with the modern-day color line. One of the things that I have found interesting over the years is how much has changed since the Civil Rights Movement, legally. There are many, many legal protections. But economically and psychologically, there's a different kind of racism now. And most of the books that I'm aware of and the films are always going back to slavery or to pre-civil rights. And I wanted to look a little bit at where people are now in this more sort of nuanced prejudice that comes from without and within. Because the color line, which is this way of looking at people of color based on how light they are on the spectrum, how dark or light, and that still exists. And so the book is about people of different colors, dealing with these sort of nuanced elements of racism and how they prevail and how they come to support and engage each other. It's not political and it's not sociological. It's just, it's character-based fiction. It just happens to have this subtext of race.
See, as a writer myself, that sounds like an extremely complicated process to go through as a writer. Did you find yourself in the process ever getting lost or going off on tangents, or did you stay pretty focused throughout the entire writing process?
The book is the book has been written, I swear, 85 times.
Right.
Yeah, you do get lost. I'm a sort of economical writer by nature, but I go through a lot of editing and a lot of deleting. Cutting and trashing, killing the darlings. And
that's funny you say that. That's true. Yeah.
It had a different title and a different subtext at the beginning. It was more feminist, and it was called "She Runs" because just almost everybody in the book was running at that time in some way or another. And then I realized that there was too many different things going on, and the characters kept saying, "No, no, over here."
Yeah. The characters so led you.
The characters absolutely led me.
Yeah.
So it is complicated. It's a complicated process, and you make choices. Writers, you know, every word is a choice. But And then so you hope for the best.
So at some point in the process, you'd like dropped the entire theme of running, which at one point was something that was emerging in your head.
I dropped it as a primary theme, absolutely. And I dropped a whole set of characters, actually, after the first draft. And I had readers going through it and responding and working through it and so on. There was a set, a family and a set of characters that went off on a whole other tangent, went off in a whole other place. And I said, oh, no, you have to go. So they left. They were exited. They're in the wings for another book.
Right, exactly.
And another set of characters replace them.
I have to say that one of the things that I do find most interesting, I haven't had the opportunity to read the entire book, but I have read excerpts from the book, mm-hmm. is that I do find it incredibly interesting and complex that it's not a book about black and white, that it's mm-mm. a book about the space in between
Thank
black
you, yes.
and white and those relationships, which I find incredibly
you.
Interesting
well
and complex.
Said. Thank you.
The other thing that I really enjoy about the book is the way that it's structured. Because this book starts not at the end, and that's a convention that a lot of writers use. We'll start at the end and then work our way back to the beginning. You start right before the end.
Right.
And then you sort of work your way back and then come back to the end. And it really is told as sort of a series of short stories almost that ultimately link together in this final conclusion.
It
yes?
is kind of. And I think of them as portraits. You know, in one way, the one thing I do think is a little different about this book is it's a little bit of a hybrid in the telling. It's fiction. But because I have 9 primary characters and all the people that go with them, and 9 or 10 really primary chapters, each one revolving around one of those characters, I had to get a lot of information in about them. And so I did it in an almost journalistic way. So they're less like short stories and almost like profiles or mini biographies. Mm-hmm. So I give the sense of the character in most of the chapters early on, and then I zero in on a particular anecdote or incident that best exemplifies their particular struggle. And all the other characters weave in and out. And so it is like connected stories, but it's almost more like profiles.
Do you get inside the head of your characters in these chapters then?
Yeah, it's a third person telling, but a very close in telling. So we're in their heads, yeah.
Okay, very interesting. And you know, I kind of did some excerpts as well, because it's online. People can go to Amazon, buy it on a Kindle.
E-reader, yeah, all the e-readers. It's available for all the e-readers.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
As well, yeah.
And you open with a quote, and when is there time to remember, to sift, to weigh, to estimate, to total?
Tilly Olson.
Who's a feminist writer as well.
Yes,
yeah?
A feminist and just one of the great black writers. And that is from that story, from I Stand Here Ironing.
Yeah.
And she's, in effect, responding to a teacher. A teacher has requested she come in and talk about her teenage daughter, so you know there's a problem.
Yeah.
And she's trying to say, you know, all of these things that have happened in my life have happened to her and our lives together, and when do you really get to look at it in its totality?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was kind of trying to do a little bit in the book.
Yeah.
Let's take a music break.
Sure.
Yes, let's.
And then we'll come back and talk more with Randy Kraft about Colors of the Wheel. This is Nina Simone, off the request line.
Yes.
This is her version of Ooh, Ooh, Child.
Ooh.
How are we doing over there?
Ready?
We're ready.
Here we go. Someday when the world is much brighter, Welcome back. You're listening to The Friendship Show on KX93.5 FM. My name is Mark Miller.
And we should point out that Mark is using his cell phone to either shine a light or use a microphone to read your notes. I can't figure out which. Okay, gotcha.
Thanks for pointing that out. The type is too small, so I'm doing everything I possibly can to read things that I have in front of me. We're talking with Randy Kraft, the author of Colors of the Wheel. Randy, recently, you wrote or were quoted as saying, age is a writer's ally. Mm-hmm. The greater the experience, the more we have to say, more time to learn important truths, to establish a more expansive point of view, to refine skills, to find your voice, and ultimately more stories to be told. This novel could never have been written 20 years ago.
Right.
I think the more I see you lately, and I see you less frequently, every time I see you, there seems to be a light that shines through you. So I guess my first question would be, what truths have you learned?
Oh, no.
What truths have you learned?
I don't think I can answer that question.
Of course you can.
Does God exist?
Oh, please. I cannot help you there with anything.
Really?
I think I've learned the truths that nothing is concrete, nothing is predictable, that we really do have to live in the moment and accept what comes and use that in some way. I think when I was younger, I was always trying to sort of manipulate my own environment and myself rather than breathing through it, so... Honestly, Mark, that's the only truth I think I have for
really?
This morning.
When it comes
I'll
down
email
to
you
it,
when I come out with
when
some
it
more.
Comes down to it, go with the flow.
I wouldn't say it that way, but yeah, yeah, something like that. But just age provides incredible clarity, and you also the older you get, the less you feel you have to prove, and it's
right.
Very
and isn't
handy.
Isn't it about really sort of being able to see like what is the important stuff around
right.
you, and
right.
and the older you get, the things that you thought were important aren't
right.
really that important after
but
all.
But the other thing is I was writing in my 30s, and the first book I wrote was just awful, and it was a good, really good exercise and a good learning thing, but I had nothing to say. And some writers, when they're young, they just seem to have so much to say and so much wisdom. And I'm a late bloomer. For me, it just took longer to feel like I could say something meaningful.
When you say this novel couldn't have been written 20 years ago, is it because of what has happened in the course of history in the last 20 years?
No.
That these stories wouldn't have existed? Or is it that you wouldn't have been able to find your way through this 20 years ago?
Well, mostly I wouldn't have been able to find my way through it 20 years ago. But also, things have changed, certainly in the Obama era. And that really informs the book as well. What some people are now calling post-racialist America, which is a really interesting term. And so I don't think the book itself, the subject matter, would have come up 20 years ago.
How would one define say that?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
There is a movement afoot that we need to be beyond any sense of race or racism in America. Which is an interesting way of looking at it. Like, okay, let's get past all this now. And I think somewhat inspired by a black president. But then there are people saying, well, yes, there's a African-American president. That doesn't mean racism has ended in America, hardly. Mm-hmm. So, but they're calling it, it's a new term. They're coining it mm-hmm. post-racialist America.
I think, and I know you say the novel isn't political, right. although it takes
some
place
politics,
on,
yeah.
on the eve of Barack Obama's re-election or
the
first
day
election.
Of his second election.
The day
yeah.
of his second but election, it, which gives it a political context.
Yeah.
There are some people who would say that the election of a black president in America has actually intensified racism on a certain level.
Absolutely.
Because a black man has risen to such a position in a white culture.
Well, I heard a statistic the other day that was really sobering, that prior to President Obama's election in 2008, there were 350 known white supremacist groups in America, and now there are 1,200. So, but for every action, there's a reaction, right?
Sure, right.
So it's both ways.
One of the themes of the book are blended families. Mm-hmm. Dawn Price is
yeah.
on the phone, and she yes. wanted to call from her vacation to
That's
weigh
great.
In on this a little bit.
Yeah.
Dawn, are you there?
I am.
Oh,
there she is.
How are things in Arizona?
Oh, it's beautiful here.
Is it?
Been having a great trip, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in on your day off.
Sure, no problem.
I know.
Hi, Randy.
Hi. Glad to hear you.
I have to say before we say anything else, I'm just so proud of Randy for doing this. It's ever since I've known Randy, she's talked about her novels. I've known Randy a little over 5 years, and so kind of in the time frame that she's sort of brought this to fruition, and it's just so tremendous. Congratulations.
Thank you.
To have this
Thank you.
A reality.
Thank you.
I know, Dawn, we wanted to get your perspective on this because you are part of a blended family, and that is one of the things that is dealt with and talked about in this book.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to read parts of the book?
I have. My goal was to get through it before today, but I'm kind of savoring it, and so I'm not through it at all. But I've further along than the sample on Kindle, so that's helpful. Our family most closely matches Margot and Danielle as the adoptive parents and their daughter who becomes the central figure, I think, Randy, you called her the thread that
yeah.
carries through the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because my husband and I are both white, and we adopted an African-American child. He was 9 weeks old, so he's been with us since he was a baby. And so we've had this experience of we're living in that space in between races, I would say, because there's lots of things that have nothing to do with race, but then all of a sudden race will be there.
How is that experience? Like, what would be an example of that, I guess?
Well, I think early on we were so naive, you know, and we were... we just wanted to be parents. We weren't interested in, you know, people will, when you adopt a child, a black child, and that's my only experience, I've never adopted otherwise, a lot of people say things to you like, you know, what a wonderful thing you're doing and, you know, giving him a better future. And there's some really thinly veiled racism in that statement. I don't think people intend it to be cruel, but there's some right. assumptions they're making that somehow our, you know, vantage point of middle class and some privilege and white culture can improve his prospects somehow. But that wasn't our intention at all. Our intention was to be parents. We were
He's the only baby
parents.
That would have you, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And we find, you know, we're so thankful that's how it worked out. We can't imagine being parents to anyone else. You know, early on, I think we expected race to be more important in areas where it really hasn't been at all. Early on, we were intentional. We went to some black churches. We were really intentional about his first haircut and going to a black barber and things like that. We were very intentional, I think, in very naive and superficial ways. But what I noticed first with a black baby was how I, as a white woman, was treated differently when he was with me. And I think those are some of the themes that Randy's getting at in her book, and the assumptions the world makes about you when your family appears to be something. So when I was at a grocery store with my black infant and my white self by myself, stores that previously had never needed identification for my checks needed identification for my checks.
Wow.
Stores, department stores that I'd walked through with no issues, I was now being followed by security. And I saw this little piece of the black experience because I was being viewed not so much through a lens of race, but through a lens of, I would say, class. The assumption the world was making about me was that probably that I was a single mother, or if not, that I was a, you know, a lower class white woman who had decided to live with or marry or more likely just sleep with a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden I was treated in a way I'd never experienced. And the anger from that rose very quickly. And I went from being someone who couldn't understand why black people were so angry to someone who was far angrier than any of her black friends on the issue of race. And then you calm down and you realize it's a new reality. And our family was treated completely differently if it was all three of us, because then we were the magnanimous white people who had given this black child a home.
Interesting.
And so, then we were treated very differently. So it's very, I think for me in particular, and we've talked about this as a family, for me in particular, I was really living in a couple of different realities depending on who was showing up in our family in that particular moment.
I mean, but you and your husband, of course, Jerry, we've all met Jerry here.
Yeah.
You're the adult and you're, you know, educated and enlightened people, and you can sort of get yourselves through it because you can understand what's going on. Is there a point where it becomes obvious to your child as they're growing up that things are being treated differently or being viewed differently? And how do you parent through that experience?
Well, our son is 21 now. He was aware of his differences. I don't remember a time when he wasn't aware of his differences. I have a strong memory of him at about 2.5 or 3 sitting in a fast food restaurant and looking up at us, not complaining, just observing. And he said, "I'm the only black person in this McDonald's." And he was very, very small. And the fact that he was already taking role, I guess, or taking account of how different he was in his environment in the moment, was a little jarring. We moved to a neighborhood where his neighborhood school was an inner city magnet school. And so his early school years he was in the majority in school. But I think what he would tell you, we should have had him on today. He learned very quickly that he didn't completely fit in that world either, because it wasn't his experience. Even at 5 and 6, that was no longer his experience of the black culture experience of an inner city school.
So,
one of the things I learned in some of the research that I did and some of the psychologists I talked to and so on in preparation for the book is how children of biracial mixed marriages or biracial families or blended families really do struggle with the identity. You
know, yeah.
With whom do they identify? And they always feel a little bit of an outsider. It's an interesting, and that's probably the most common mm-hmm. experience for all of them.
One of the observations you have in the book, Randy, is so spot on from what we heard. When we heard that the child that was, we had about a 6-week period between knowing he would be our child and him actually coming home to us.
Mm.
And my husband worked at a university and we had for dinner 2 students who had been transracially adopted. So they were black students who had been grown up in white families, for their advice and their perspective. And they both said that. They both said that there was a point that they had to choose, that they were required sort of in the college environment to choose whether they were going to be black or not be black. Mm. It's not really be black or be white, but it's sort of, are you going to be black or not?
Yeah.
And that that choice, and I think you speak about that at one point. And then the other thing you say that they both said, and they both asked that we not quote them on it. I'm not saying their names, but I think it's safe now, is that they knew they would have a leg up, that they were able, when they left college, to seamlessly move between the two worlds.
Mm. You know, Megan has something she wants to contribute here. Megan?
I come from a mixed race family. So my dad is part African American, my mom's white. And so I'm really proud of my heritage because it's like my mom's Spanish and German and Irish, and uh-huh. my dad's, uh-huh. you know, African and Cherokee, and there's probably some Italian in there too. And
wow.
I was lucky that they were, they put a lot of thought into raising me and my identity and everything, that I just only saw myself as a human. I never had to pick. I knew where both of my families, both sides of my families came
where
from.
Where they came from.
But yeah. I never was forced or, you know, no stereotypes were forced on me.
You
like,
were
not,
yeah.
You it was not a not unique experience.
Did
so
you
are post-racialist.
No, and I think that has changed, Megan. I think that has, where I was leading is that I don't think our son had to do that either. I think we were 20 years ago talking with college students in their experience in that moment, and that was their reality. I haven't seen my son have to do that, and I'm glad you haven't either. I think that is something that has changed pretty drastically during your lifetime and his.
Megan, I'm curious, did your peers ever confront this issue with you?
Well, I think eventually it did start to become an issue for me, only because it's like I would look in the mirror and I would just see Megan. Like, I didn't see a white girl, a, you know, quarter black girl. Like, I didn't see that. And then it was probably towards the end of high school, and it's definitely in college, that people will come up to me and say, "What race are you? Like, what are you?" And mm-hmm. That was offending to me because mm-hmm. it's like, I'm a human just like you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what my background is, but mm-hmm. people had to put me into a category to mm-hmm. then
exactly.
be able to interact with me.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that was the frustrating thing that I hear quite frequently from people who come from a very, you know, rich background.
Right.
I have a character in the book. Mm-hmm. She's the feistiest of all of them. She's very, very light-skinned, and she can pass, and she just doesn't want to deal with race at all. Mm-hmm. She's delusional about it, and not you, but but she, you know, she is also sort of constantly avoiding and resisting this idea of having to be pigeonholed, having yeah. to be identified as something.
Right, and that's what people are most comfortable.
Well, that's what we do in America.
Yeah, people yeah. like to categorize
we do
anything,
everywhere, actually.
Like even outside of race, categories are
exactly.
necessary.
Right, there's a hierarchy. So, yeah.
How much research went into this book?
I did not do... I did not do scholarly research mm-hmm. by any means. I did counsel for a long time with a friend of mine who is a professor of women's history with a specialty in black women's history.
Okay.
So she gave me this gigantic bibliography, which I could have had a PhD if I'd read. But mm-hmm. I read a number of books. Mm-hmm. I interviewed a number of people. And at some point I thought, I think I know enough to tell the story. And if I keep researching, I'm going to get bogged down in the research, and I will belabor the fiction. So
was it difficult to write in the voice of a person of another ethnicity?
Well, because I was telling it in third person, so I wasn't in their voice
okay.
exactly, but
yeah.
I was in their heads.
Mm-hmm.
That was sometimes, yes,
mm-hmm.
very difficult. And Keisha, the young girl, the thread, mm-hmm. Who's adopted like Don's wonderful son, by mm-hmm. the way, she is raised differently. She's raised in a very white world, and she's raised in, as if she's white, but she's conscious of the fact that she's not. But she is befriended by a friend of the family
mm-hmm.
who's a brown man, himself the result of a biracial family, and he becomes extremely important to her. He becomes an anchor because when she looks at him, she sees herself, and he takes a special interest in her. And that becomes very important to her in her own identity as a black woman.
And in the process of writing this book, you had mentioned earlier readers.
Yeah.
How many readers did you have, first of all, roughly?
The first draft, I had about 8 or 10 readers.
Was this a writer's group?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't do writer's groups anymore.
And from a writer's discussion here, did you enjoy having that many readers? Because I found that process oftentimes just overwhelming because eight different readers, eight different perspectives.
Yeah. I needed it then.
Okay.
I needed it then. And the subsequent drafts, I had fewer readers. And my readers are people I know, but they're not my best friends who are going to be kind to me necessarily.
Yeah.
And they're particularly good readers or editors. And so it's a very helpful part of the process.
When did you know the book was completed? Because as a writer, I can work on it until a deadline comes up and I need a check. But how did you know a novel, you're not getting paid for it until you sell? You know, how did you know you were done?
You know, there's a wonderful story, by the way, about the great writer Tom Wolfe, who never thinks he's done, and his publishers would literally send a courier to come into his house and extract the manuscript.
Is that how this worked for you?
Well, I kind of just said, if I keep at this, I'm going to ruin it.
Yeah.
Because at some point you can over-edit as well.
Of course.
But I can pick it up right now, and turn to almost any page and change a word.
Sure.
I promise you that.
Yeah.
And I think, if anything, I could have filled in more of the gaps, but I really wanted it. I wanted to leave as much open to the interpretation as possible.
Great.
So.
And the road to publishing. Every writer wants to know the road to publishing. Yeah. What was that experience?
Well, these days, the self-publishing world has just opened doors.
Like, it's amazing how it's changed.
Crazy. Unbelievable.
And it's not what it was. The stigma attached to that
because
nothing.
Good writers are self-publishing,
of course.
Thankfully. But in 2003, I finished a novel, and I had a big agent in New York who was going to sell it toot sweet, and you know that didn't quite happen.
This book?
No, a different book.
Okay.
A different book. It was the second one. And it was a very laborious process and very disappointing to me at the time because it was a good book, and I'm actually going to go rework that one now. But when it came to this round, I thought, okay, so it's going to take me now maybe a year to find a good agent because it's very difficult, very difficult. And then that agent could take up to a year to sell it. And then it takes a good year or so for a traditional publisher to publish.
Sure.
So I really want this book to sit for 3 years waiting for representation. No. And that's part of being older and wiser. It's like, okay, I don't need to do this. And I just figured out which way I wanted to self-publish because there are a variety of ways to go.
And?
I chose a vanity press.
Gotcha.
Because I wanted somebody who would put out a good product and who could get it out to the distributors so that if bookstores wanted it, they could have it.
Uh-huh.
And who would manage the process so that I wouldn't have to. But I did, I was able to put it up on Amazon and through all the other e-readers myself through the formatting, and it's unbelievably simple. It's just amazing.
You know, I agree with you on agents, by the way. I think every nonfiction book I ever sold, I sent out query letters to agents and got rejected every single time. And it was my due diligence and to go after getting it published that I would go directly to the publishers.
Yeah.
The agents were of no service to me whatsoever, so I agree with you on that point.
Which you can't do with fiction.
The self-publishing process now, I mean, you're kind of the Jane of all trades there.
Uh-huh.
You got to kind of proof your own materials. Yes. You got to work on the cover. Did you go through that process?
I hired a young woman in Dana Point who's still in school, an aspiring graphic artist, but she's very good.
Nice.
So I hired her to do the cover.
Very nice.
And she did, I think, a very nice job.
It looks great.
And I have a proofreader, a retired librarian with a vicious red pen.
Wow, I got to get her number.
Yeah, and she twice went through it for me, and then I had to proof with the publisher myself.
Yeah.
It's a long process.
And it's hot off the press. I mean, you were saying that the books aren't even going to be delivered.
Yeah, the books will be in California probably Thursday, and the 30th we're having a book launch at Laguna Beach Books is being kind enough to host the book launch. And then my bookstore in Connecticut, which is where I'm from, they're gonna have it as well, and we're gonna do something in the spring, I hope.
Now you become not just a writer, not just a publisher. Now you become a marketer. Now you got to figure out how to go out and promote that book because people don't automatically gravitate toward, you know, Randy Kraft's book on Amazon.com unless they've heard about you.
100,000 books published, and I'm not exaggerating. But you know what? I have a background in marketing, but I'm kind of, I'm going to do a few things
uh-huh.
and then I'm going to rely on the kindness of my friends to spread the word and see if the book finds its own life. And if it doesn't, you know, I what I want to do is write.
Yeah.
A very successful writer many years ago once cautioned me,
uh-oh,
watch out for getting sucked into the publishing process. It'll zap all your creative juices.
Right.
Keep writing. And I'm going to take that advice.
And you maintain, you maintain a writer's lifestyle in a lot of ways,
right,
because, you know, you and I have had a couple of meetings in the past on things, and we meet down there at that little coffee shop where you set up your little corner and and you're inspired by the faces, almost like an artist is inspired by faces and applause. Yeah?
I split my life up so that I do my day job, the work I get paid for at home.
Yeah.
And I write fiction in one of three or four cafes around town, mostly a lot at Pan du Monde. And so I call it my office. But I really, I take in the conversations, the texture, the energy of the people around me. It helps infuse the fiction, I think.
And that's a beautiful lifestyle, honestly.
It's a lovely lifestyle.
And to writers who are listening, writers who want to publish, writers who want to finish, everybody, I found a lot of people want to write.
Uh-huh.
Few people actually make an attempt.
Uh-huh.
Even fewer actually complete that process.
Right. It's
hard. What advice would you give? What would somebody need? What skill set would somebody need in order to complete the process of writing a novel, which is a very complicated, long process?
Well, you have to have the passion for it, of course, and really, really want to do it. And then you have to carve out the time. My advice to writers, if you want to write, you have to write.
Right.
And you really have to work at it all the time.
Right.
Ron Carlson, a wonderful writer who runs the UCI MFA program, calls it staying in the room.
Mm.
You know, don't leave the room.
Yeah.
Don't go get the coffee and read the newspaper. Just stay there and stay with your characters and keep working the material, and it will happen.
Is a pretty fairly common exercise, isn't it? Where it's like you're going to write for 1 hour a day, or you're going to write 5 pages.
Right.
And what, because I've been through this process a little bit in doing some playwriting.
Yes.
Where they say, I don't care how good it is or how bad it is.
Yes.
You just have to get something on the paper.
Exactly.
So you get that part of the muscle strengthened. And it's just like, I can write. It's really bad right now, but I can get better.
Exactly. I try to do, 3 hours of fiction a day. If I get one good page, I am thrilled. And I may end up trashing that page anyway, but you just got to keep writing.
And I thought it was really interesting that you said, like, even now, like, you could go back and read a page of something that you've written and pick single words and
Absolutely.
Go, I don't like that particular word.
Absolutely. Kills me.
And because I would say that sometimes I'll do the same thing where it's like, I need a different word because I don't like this many syllables. It throws off the rhythm of this line.
Rhythm is a
and
big
so
deal.
I need another, I have to find something else because this is too much or not enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does it get that crazy?
Yeah. And it's funny you say rhythm, because for me, the writing, I hear it in a kind of rhythm. It's very rhythmic for me, the language. And the writers I like the best are the writers I feel who have a very interesting rhythm, what they call voice. But it's kind of more about rhythm.
What writers have inspired you?
Oh, my God.
Name two.
So many.
Name two.
Name two.
Yeah.
Somerset Maugham, who I think is one of the great underrated writers of the 20th century and mm-hmm. very prolific, and he called himself a simple storyteller. He was mm-hmm. a fabulous storyteller, and The Razor's Edge is still one of my very all-time favorite books.
Very nice.
And in a more contemporary way, I'd say Barbara Kingsolver.
Hmm.
I just think she's very special as a writer and as a human being, the things she writes about.
Tell us again where you're appearing next on the 30th, I believe
Thursday,
it is.
Thursday the 30th, 6 o'clock at Laguna Beach Books. And the book will be available there, and it's also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble's and in paperback and for all e-readers. Thank you for asking.
I just have a feeling you're going to be a huge success,
oh,
Randy.
You're
a bright woman, and there's nothing more sexy than a bright, articulate woman, and I do believe that.
I'll take it. Thank you. Thank you.
Dawn, are you still with us?
I am.
Thank you.
We're getting ready to wrap up. Anything you want to add before we go this morning?
I'm excited for Randy, and I hope the world wants to hear this story because it needs to be told.
And if you like it, Dawn, tell your friends.
I will.
I would say that this morning I read a review of the book of someone who read it and then posted it on somewhere.
Great.
And I believe said was an important new voice in the literary
Isn't
world.
Isn't that amazing?
Randy
and
Kraft.
I hardly know that woman. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's got to be exciting.
Yeah, she's a friend of a friend, and it's fabulous. I'm so grateful for it.
Wonderful.
All right. What are we doing? What's going on?
Oh,
Gosh.
What are you doing? Huh? What are you doing?
I'm not doing anything. I think we're getting ready to say goodbye.
Oh, you were looking around.
Like, I'm a little sad to have to do it.
Oh. I'm on my way to the swap meet in Arizona.
Oh, you are? Okay, yeah. Good luck. Get lots of stuff.
Bye, everybody.
Have a great trip.
All right. Thanks. Randy Kraft, I would say it has been well worth the wait to finally get you here.
Thank you. The pleasure was mine.
Will you come back again sometime?
I will.
On the second novel.
You bet.
All right. Fantastic. You've been listening to The Friendship Show on KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. My name is Mark Miller saying goodbye for Scott Hayes. I think we're going to listen to some Sade on our way out the door. Hey. Ida Mae is up next.
No, Ida Mae.
Ida Mae's not out there?
I don't think so. I think we have a special guest and musicians in.
Oh,
so
really?
They're out there rehearsing right now.
Must be Tommy. Tommy must be coming up. Here we go.